Welcome to the Smart Family Podcast, where we want to help you love being home. Here are your hosts, Dr. Rob Meter and Tony Newhoff.
Well, hello there and welcome to the Smart Family Podcast. I'm so excited that you've tuned in today. We have a different kind of episode for you today. I have my co-host, Dr. Rob Meter, here with me in the studio, and he is on the hot seat.
Yes. Thanks, Tony. Thanks for this. And I'm excited about today, too.
Yes. Well, for those of you who don't know, Dr. Rob is a pediatrician with over 20 years experience. And right now he serves as the medical director of the Family, Child, and Youth Mental Health Service at the Waypoint Center in Midland, Ontario. Mm-hmm. That's a mouthful.
Yeah, no, but you got it right. No, that's good. And I've been there actually more recently now. And really, my practice is focused just on mental health and behavior in kids and like teenagers and younger kids as well, but also families in general, right? Like, I always like to view these issues not happening in isolation in a child. It's usually the whole family is involved to some extent. And so I think addressing this in that, you know, from that perspective is really important.
Yes. And I know you've shared with me before that there are questions that parents come to you with over and over and over again. Mm-hmm. And we thought it would be great to consolidate some of these into an episode where we talk about explosive behavior and ADHD and some of the things that you get asked
like on a daily
time
basis.
Time and time again. Yes.
Yeah. And also that some of our listeners have brought up, you know, over the course of our, you know, 1 year of episodes now on the Smart Family Podcast. So yeah, this is hopefully going to be helpful for people.
Well, Rob, I'm going to start us off with the very first question, which is, well, let's start at the basics. How would you describe behavior?
That's a really good question, actually, because, you know, when we think about behavior, we're really talking about the things that we can see and sometimes measure, really almost on the surface. And in fact, for a long time, mental health was focused and still is in many ways focused on those things that we can see on the surface. And I like to think of the analogy of an iceberg. Like if you think about the tip of the iceberg, you know, we have that expression, there's that tip of the iceberg, which is really the little piece that's showing above the water. But then there's this huge iceberg underneath the water. And I think if we just focused on addressing behavior, we might, you know, address that tip of the iceberg, but not really address what's underneath the surface. And so, yeah, so how do you get at changing that behavior? Well, you really need to look at what's underneath the surface. And so it's useful to categorize behavior as being sort of, you know, internalizing behavior, which is kind of more withdrawn and isolating and quieter, versus externalizing behavior, which is that more explosive type behavior that we might see.
Okay.
So, or whether someone is hyper aroused or dissociative. I mean, these are all kind of terms that we might use.
Right. And so what do you mean by hyper aroused or dissociative?
Well, so this all refers to different parts of the brain that are involved in behavior. You know, we have almost like a continuum of how we might respond to certain stressors. And so all behavior happens when we as children, or even all of us, are trying to respond to a stressor. So, and I think Stuart Shanker talks about this in, you know, his self-reg, and, you know, we'll go back a few episodes and listen to that. But, you know, the five domains of stress that he talks about are, you know, there's the biological stressors, there's cognitive stressors, there's emotional stressors, social and pro-social stressors. Those are the five domains he talks about. And so if you think about it, all behavior results from trying to address those stressors. When something knocks us sort of off kilter or off balance, we want to try and regain that balance. And that's where behaviors come in to try and restore that balance. So that's where, you know, someone might be, you know, hyper aroused is more like an externalizing behavior where you're, well, it's kind of like it suggests, you know, you're kind of hyper vigilant, you're a bit fidgety, on edge. And that can be extreme too. It can be aggressive, can be, you know, running away. And whereas dissociative type behavior is more like withdrawn and freezing, sometimes becoming completely withdrawn from a situation. Even daydreaming might be dissociating, but sometimes we even see like what we call conversion disorders, where people completely, you know, are out of it and unresponsive. Right. So that's in extreme stressors. We see those kinds of responses. So, and that really reflects like what part of our brain is involved. I mean, if we're able to sort of rationally respond to a stressor, well, that means the smart part of our brain is working, the cortical part of our brain. Whereas if we're having an extreme stress, we're going right back down to brainstem responses and, you know, our heart rate changes, our breathing rate changes, and sometimes our entire state of consciousness changes.
Right. So that's the spectrum. And that would be what's involved if somebody's triggered.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, and triggered is sort of a trauma type word that we use, you know, when something that we see or experience triggers a certain response, because in the past, you know, there may have been an association made in our brains, you know, with a certain situation where we needed to respond in a very dramatic way because it was traumatic. Mm-hmm. And so when we re-experience that situation, our brain thinks, oh, you're in stress, you're in trouble, you need to respond in this way. Like you did in the past, you know, you need to run away. The classic, you know, paradigm for this is like post-traumatic stress disorder, right? Where someone has maybe experienced a stressor and in the past that was real, that was in a real, you know, stressful situation, and a certain response had to be elicited, a certain behavior had to be elicited in order to, you know, address that stressor. And then in the future, you know, you have that same evocative situation that might, your brain says, oh, this is trouble, you know, get out of that. And we have the same feelings that come up, the same emotions, the same sensations as if we were there again. And that's like a triggered response. So for example, Tony, I have a couple of examples that might illustrate what I was just talking about there, what triggers are, because, you know, I think a lot of times kids with autism, for example, they have a really strong, good memory. And a lot of parents of children with autism will say, yeah, you know, sometimes, you know, there's a strong reaction. We don't even know what it is. And, you know, Barry Prezant in the episode on autism talks about the classic example of a child who would get completely emotional and overwhelmed whenever they were driving by a certain area in the city. And it took a long time for mom to realize that whenever we drive past that building, there's a strong response. And then she realized that building looks exactly like a doctor's office where a year ago he had a needle that was a very stressful experience. And so in that child, you know, that situation and that visual memory triggered a strong response, even when, of course, it was a completely different situation and very benign.
Right.
Just a few days ago, I had a child who, you know, had gone through a very stressful situation with his biological father abusing him. And, you know, very often when he is reminded of his father, so there's a phone call or he hears the tone of voice that resembles his father, he starts to have a very strong physical reaction and the behavior deteriorates or escalates. And so that also would be considered like a triggered response to some trauma or stress that happened sometimes even years ago, and that needs to be worked on, right? That's that, you know, if you want to get to the behavior, the response, you need to address that underlying stressor that has been triggered.
Right, yeah. And so what would you do to address it for a child?
Well, so the important thing is to process this in a therapeutic manner, right? And this is where therapists come in. Sure, there's a role for medication to help damp down some of those symptoms, especially if they're severe, right? And that often will help the child access, you know, different forms of therapy. But, you know, when we talk about trauma specifically, we use things like EMDR, eye movement desensitization and reprocessing, which is a specific form where the child, you know, is able to deal with his traumatic incidents. I won't go into the details here right now, but, you know, it's just kind of one example of a therapeutic modality that we might use for trauma. But, you know, in general with behaviors, yeah, there's, you know, again, if you just address the tip of the iceberg, you're just going to get this behavior come up again and again and again. Mm-hmm. You really want to get at like, well, what are the actual difficulties? What are the stressors that are leading to that behavior? You know, asking why is this happening and why now?
Right. Especially, I've heard you mention this before, it's important with kids who have explosive behavior.
Exactly.
Because, yeah, can you explain why?
Well, that's explosive behavior is a great example of a behavior that often comes to clinical attention because it is so severe and distressing for us as parents or maybe teachers or whoever might be around the child, right? Because, you know, it's interesting. I often hear parents say, like, oh, yeah, he just goes from 0 to 100. We're not even sure why. Like, it'll be some minor thing. I might say something or, like, you know, put your lunch away and suddenly it goes from 0 to 100. Well, kids rarely go from 0 to 100. You know, what most often happens is during the course of the day, they've been going from 0 to 80 with, you know, little stress after little stress that hasn't been, you know, dealt with or that keeps building up. When they get home, they're already under the surface at like 60 or 70. And then, you know, it's that like one little thing, that one look or one remark or one request that's the stressor that is, you know, goes from 80 to 100. Mm-hmm. And so often I think we think a child, just because they're quiet, doesn't necessarily mean they're calm, right? And so sometimes quiet kids, there's stuff underneath the surface that's been accumulating over the course of the day or maybe even weeks or longer, right? That something like that might be building up. Child might internalize it for a long time and then finally just externalizes and lets it all out. So, you know, that's an example of explosive behavior that, well, again, we have to look at what was happening before that, you know, what was leading up to that. And I think Ross Green talks about this in The Explosive Child. Mm-hmm. You know, he says, you know, really start to drill down and figure out, like, what is a child having difficulty with? What is the expectation that they're not able to meet that we can perhaps help them out with so that we don't get these maladaptive type behaviors, these explosive episodes, and we can actually help the child with the difficulties that lead to those explosive behaviors.
Right. And do you find with most of your patients who are experiencing explosive behavior that you need to work collaboratively with a child therapist, for example? Like, is it usually a joint approach or is it weighted one way or the other?
Yeah, well, you know, it is always, I mean, many things can be managed just with, you know, education, you know, making parents aware, like, this is how it happens. You know, when we see explosive behavior, we really see more stress behavior. Your child is moving to a more stressed part of their brain when they're having a stressor. So let's try and identify the stressor and work on that. And really, a lot of times, just knowing that, understanding that kind of paradigm or way of thinking is awesome for parents to realize and understand, because it puts it into a whole different perspective. It's like, again, what Ross Green calls changing the lenses of behavior. But sometimes, you know, it is and useful to get a therapist involved. And sometimes this is exactly what the therapist will talk about with them. You know, many therapists that I work with at different family health teams, they talk about using exactly that collaborative problem-solving approach with the kids. Now, collaborative problem-solving, you know, when I say that, it's basically how do you address these difficulties with kids in a collaborative way? But just think about it. That's going to involve the thinking part of your brain, right? You're not going to do that in the heat of the moment when a child is in, like, the stress part of their brain.
Right. So, and during the explosive episode,
yeah,
you can't just talk them out of it.
No. And that's the time where you're going to work with your child on a much less verbal way. You know, you're going to use what I think Mona Delahook calls limbic to limbic. You know, that's like that, you know, that lower part of your brain to your child's lower part of your brain.
Lower emotional part.
Yeah, that's right. You're going to emote with them. You're going to mirror how they're feeling. You're going to let your child know, hey, I heard you. I've seen your behavior. It's a signal. It's a communication. You want to tell me that you're stressed. I hear you. And once the child understands that, okay, my mom's hearing me or my dad's understanding, you know, they usually calm down. And then afterwards, when they're calm, when they're back in the thinking part of their brain, okay, the cortex, that's when you can have a conversation and start doing collaborative problem solving. And you'd be surprised. Even young kids are good at that. You know, the steps to collaborative problem solving is empathic listening. You know, ask your child, what's the difficulty? Or what are your thoughts about what maybe, you know, led to that explosion that happened yesterday or a couple of hours ago? And then you can list your adult concerns too. Say, well, this is what I'm concerned about. And you can try to collaboratively, you know, look at this difficulty that led to that behavior and try and solve it together. And that's, you know, what he calls plan B, right? So yes. Rather than unilaterally imposing a solution like, okay, this is what I want to have happen. Next time, you know, you got to do this, this, and this. Those solutions almost never stick. If you can get the child somehow involved in addressing the difficulty or the unmet expectation, it's much more likely to stick. So yeah, I'm always a fan of collaborative problem solving.
So are there diagnoses or disorders that children with explosive behavior might be diagnosed with?
Yeah. And there are lots of diagnoses, right? And, you know, it's important to really put the issue of diagnoses in context. I think sometimes in the mental health profession, you know, we've been focused a bit too much on a diagnosis, you know, when it's probably more helpful to focus on the actual difficulties underneath the surface. I mean, a diagnosis generally is just a name given to a constellation of symptoms, right? So, you know,
right.
Intermittent explosive disorder. Well, that means the child is intermittently explosive. I mean, it doesn't tell you a whole lot, right?
Sure.
Or, you know, even ADHD, attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. Well, this child has difficulty with attention and is hyperactive. It's almost more descriptive. It doesn't really tell you exactly like what the difficulty is underneath it. And that's why even in my practice, I've been focusing a lot less on pinning down a diagnosis as to really sitting down and saying, okay, what are the actual difficulties here? Where are we having issues? What are the triggers or the stressors that are leading to the behavior that brings us here today? And so I think if you take a more pragmatic approach to it, rather than saying, okay, this is a diagnosis, you know, it helps just to dial back a little bit and saying like, what's actually a useful approach here, rather than saying, okay, this is the diagnosis, this is the box that you fit in. Because what we find is that behaviors can probably fit a lot of diagnoses. You know, a hyperactive child, well, that might be ADHD, or that could fit with, you know, intermittent explosive disorder, could fit with oppositional defiant disorder. But if we don't know the cause of that hyperactivity, you know, is there like hypervigilance due to trauma that's leading to that hyperactivity? Is there some other reason why the child is restless? It's much better to focus on the reasons that lead to the behavior than on like the diagnosis that might, you know, fit most closely with that child at that time.
Right. Do you find that there are medications that help with explosive behavior?
Yeah. And again, this is where you want to put medications in context too, right? And we all know cases where kids have been put on medications for the wrong reasons, and sometimes kids who probably have needed medication but didn't get it, right? So a lot of over and misdiagnosis and a lot of misinformation about medications out there. But if you just take a step back and say, well, what do medications actually do? Well, really, all they do is they change the neurotransmitter levels in your brain, in your child's brain. And, you know, many other things can do that too. You know, certain activities change neurotransmitter levels, certain foods change neurotransmitter levels. Medications are a controlled way of doing that. Now, many times you don't need medication to address behavior, right? But sometimes if kids have significant symptoms, altering that neurotransmitter milieu in the brain can dampen down some of those symptoms and then allow therapy to proceed, you know, more effectively. And so sometimes it just works synergistically or in addition to or as an adjunct to other therapies and, you know, ways of addressing behavior and difficulties that we're seeing in a child that, you know, can support that in a more effective way and make them more effective.
Right. But we can't think about meds as replacing other forms of therapy.
Exactly. Because, you know, there's sometimes it's an unrealistic expectations that medications is going to make the child, you know, make the right decisions and have all of a sudden all the skills to solve these problems and to address these difficulties. And I always say pills don't teach skills, right? So
that's a good saying.
Yeah.
Can you say it again?
Pills don't teach skills, you know, and there definitely is a role for medications in some situations, especially when behaviors are extreme or particularly distressing or dangerous. Then we have to consider using medication, maybe even just for a short time, ideally, because all medications have side effects, right? Yes, you know, we change neurotransmitters in the part of the brain where we want, you know, it to work, but it also works in other parts of the body too. So there's always some side effects to medications in addition to the positive effects that we're trying to achieve. So I always, you know, I like to really put medications in their proper context and not give them more importance than they deserve.
So how about if we switch gears to ADHD? Mm-hmm. Is that a diagnosis that you are seeing a lot of these days?
Yes. And as we've talked about before already with regards to diagnosis in general, I mean, ADHD really just describes a set of behaviors or a set of symptoms, just like the name suggests. Difficulty with attention and hyperactivity. There's a couple different subtypes. We talk about inattentive dominant subtype or a hyperactive predominant subtype or a combined subtype. And primarily what it revolves around is difficulty with executive function, which is that front of our cortex or right behind, above our eyes, behind our foreheads is this part of the brain called the prefrontal cortex. And when that part of our brain is not really allowed to function properly, we get self-regulation difficulties, we get executive function difficulties. And executive functions are those skills that allow us to, you know, plan an activity and carry it out and not get distracted and being able to manage sort of a change in plans and stay on track. That's our executive function skills. And that is what kids tend to have problems with. And they tend to have difficulty inhibiting more impulsive behavior that comes from deeper down in the brain. So the goal for, you know, kids who are labeled with ADHD is to try and get that part of the brain to function more effectively.
So I know we've heard multiple of our parenting experts talk about how the executive function of the brain is something that develops over time, that parents need to expect that they're going to have to perform that executive function for their kids until a certain age. So exactly. So that must be tricky sometimes to tease out, you know, what is, you know, an actual disorder, you know, what is ADHD that varies from the norm and what is just normal developmental, exactly, you know, non-executive functioning.
Yeah. Sometimes behaviors that we see are entirely normal for that child's age and stage of development. If you think about it, every kid who's two probably meets criteria for ADHD. You know, because sure, that part of our brain is just not developed. That's why we don't ever make that diagnosis at that young age. In fact, we really are very careful making that diagnosis in kids who are younger because it's still normal for them. That part of our brain is right, just coming online. And I think Jennifer Calari mentions this in her episodes on connected parenting. She says, you know, we are still expected to be our child's frontal lobes, which of course includes that frontal cortex. You know, we have to help our child self-regulate. We have to help them with their planning until they can do it themselves. And those executive function skills, yes, they are developing for years and years and years. In fact, they're one of the last parts to really mature of the brain, even in adolescence. I think we all know teenagers sometimes have some difficulty with their executive functions, right? And in fact, there is a little bump in the development of those skills, even in early adolescence. And so again, because that's, you know, a more advanced part of our brain, it's one of the latest to develop. We like to talk about a sequential way that the brain develops from the brainstem, which of course is functioning as it should when we're born, towards, you know, the midbrain, the limbic system, the diencephalon, and those structures, those emotional and social parts of our development form after that. And then after that, of course, is the language and more abstract thinking parts of our brain, which includes the frontal cortex. So it's important that we don't, you know, expect a four-year-old to have all of those skills develop, right? They're just learning language. They're just learning abstract thinking. They're learning executive function skills. And so sometimes we have to be patient too, because sometimes this will still just develop. And sometimes we set unrealistic expectations for our kids at home and in a classroom. Kids classically will get perhaps even misdiagnosed if they're born later in the year. This is, there's some great studies on kids who are born in December who might be a year behind their peers in their class who were born in January, there are some really good evidence out there that many of those kids are more often diagnosed as ADHD than kids who are born in January. And that's because it's just a developmental difference, right? That's probably normal. But when you put them all in a classroom, those kids born later in the year, it's going to look like they're behind their other peers who were born earlier.
Right. So as kids develop, are there some hallmark signs that you point parents toward? Because I guess you must see this tension between, you know, parents who would tend to be overprotective and do all the planning for their kids, you know, and extend it for too long, versus, you know, parents who have no appreciation for their role in helping their kids plan and, you know, stand back and expect their kids to do things they can't do yet.
Yeah.
What signs do you point parents toward?
Well, you know, it's always important that we have realistic expectations for our kids and we help them if they need help. We buffer them as they're learning. You know, we have buffering relationships, we call that, which is supportive relationships. It's no use setting expectations which are way too high. And of course, that's where it's so important that our educational system is geared towards a child at that age and with the skills that they have. You know, if we have a bar that's set way too high, well, kids are just going to get frustrated. You know, they're going to give up and then you're going to see behavior. So whenever there is a gap between a child's abilities and our expectations, if that gap's too big, a kid's going to have trouble meeting those expectations and you're going to see behavior. And that behavior is either going to be adaptive, which is asking a question or taking a break or doing some deep breathing or something. Mm-hmm. And those are the kids that are able to manage that stress. Or it's going to be maladaptive. Kids might get angry or upset or run away or refuse to do the work. And those are the unlucky kids because generally they also tend to have more negative peer interactions because of those behaviors. And that's, you know,
they have problems making friends.
Exactly. Mm. And teachers have difficulty helping them and parents, you know, and so that leads to negative and negative interactions through a downward spiral, right? If that is persistent. So when we see kids who are struggling to meet expectations, it's important that we make sure, first of all, that our expectations are realistic, okay? Because a little gap in expectation where the child, that's exactly what they need and they can close that gap. Mm-hmm. But if it's too big, then it's impossible and you just get a child with behaviors.
I often hear parents talk about a food or a food group that they're not feeding their child because it tends to make their kids hyperactive or it agitates them. So what do you say about foods and behaviors, especially hyperactivity?
Yeah, I get asked that question quite a bit. And many parents are convinced about things like sugar, for example, causing behavior. I've heard of, you know, red dyes, other processed foods in general. And first of all, it's really hard to do good studies about foods and behavior because it's so hard to isolate the food as being the variable in those studies. In fact, most nutritional studies, Tony, are really hard to do and really not reliable. So I think what we know so far, though, is that the effect of foods on behavior is probably less than what we think. Probably what has a much bigger effect on behavior is a lack of food. So remember what I talked about earlier about the domains of stress. One of them was the biological domain. And one biological stressor is hunger. You know, and if a kid gets hungry, there actually is such a thing as hangry.
Sure.
and many times I've heard of, you know, school principals who've had a child just kind of lose it in the classroom and they end up in the principal's office and they give the kid a snack and they're much better behaved, you know? And so you wonder okay, maybe we're just dealing with some hunger there and maybe a bit of a low blood sugar that's leading to that behavior. So for sure. There, you know, I get asked about foods all the time, but in general, probably not as much there as we thought in the past.
And I've heard talk about omega-3 fatty acids. Does that have any effect on ADHD?
Well, we do think that omega-3 fatty acids have some role to play in how the brain develops and myelination of nerves, which is important for their conduction. So, of course, nerves is what your brain is made of. So we do think that in the context of brain development, omega-3 fatty acids, you know, we probably should have those in our diet. And if we're not consuming enough of them, it could plausibly affect development of the brain. So, mm-hmm. you know, if we say if there's any kind of good brain food out there, it's maybe foods that are rich in omega-3 fatty acids, especially for younger kids, right, whose brains are still rapidly developing.
Right.
I mean, if you think about it, a baby's brain triples in size before the age of five. Having some omega-3 fatty acids as part of that child's diet is probably going to be helpful.
The best food sources of omega-3 fatty acids.
Well, we think of fish, and fish mm-hmm. oils are probably
salmon.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And
what about some of the nuts, pecans, walnuts?
Yeah. But I think definitely the biggest one definitely is fish and fish oils. And some parents give cod liver oil. I know my mom tried that on me and it was gross, but we used to put drops on our porridge when we were small. That was sort of the thing we did in Holland to get omega-3 fatty acids.
Wow.
Yeah. And here I am. So
Brian, you made it. You mentioned sleep problems as a side effect of ADHD medication, but I think sleep problems in general is something that parents talk about. You know, aside from that diagnosis, I know parents, especially with young children, complain about how they just can't get their kids to go to sleep. What advice do you have?
Well, first of all, sleep is so important. Good sleep is so important. We know that as adults, right? If we're not sleeping at night, our next day is affected. We get more irritable, we're cranky. Well, same thing goes for kids. If they're not sleeping well, they're not going to function the next day. One of the big culprits in sleep is poor sleep hygiene. I know it sounds simple and basic, mm-hmm. but you'd be surprised how many teens and preteens are going to bed with the iPhones in their hands. It used to be sort of 10 years ago, I was telling parents like no TVs in the bedroom. Well, that's not the issue anymore. It's screens, handheld screens in the bedroom, right?
Sure.
Because we knew that sleep, as much as we thought, okay, just watch a movie and you'll fall asleep, it actually tended to keep the kids awake. Okay. Like it was stimulating for them.
Yes.
It wasn't calming for them. It wasn't putting them to sleep at all. Mm-hmm. And so we quickly started telling families, or not quickly, but over the years, they get the screens out of the bedroom. And right now, the big issue is handheld screens. And so sleep hygiene, having your child in a quiet, dark environment where there's no distractions like iPhones or video games, you know, having a calming routine before you go to bed.
Sure.
You know, having maybe a small snack before bedtime, having a routine where you brush your teeth, put on your pajamas, especially for young kids. I think that's really important. That's really grounding for them. The more predictable that can be, the calmer the child tends to be, right? Unpredictability right. leads to stress.
Yes.
So if you can have a predictable nighttime routine, that's often very helpful. It doesn't have to be
long. At the same time.
Yeah,
same
exactly.
time every night.
Yeah, at a reasonable mm-hmm. bedtime. You know, most kids need more sleep than adults do.
Sure.
Especially younger kids are looking at like, you know, 12 hours of sleep. Teenagers probably more like 10 hours of sleep, 8 to 10, you know, minimum. But some kids are more or less than that, right? We have to recognize that as well. Some kids just need a little bit less sleep. Some kids need more sleep. And the big sure. gauge for that is like, well, how tired and functional are they during the day? If
yes.
they're alert and functioning well, they're not, you know, falling asleep in class, they're probably getting enough sleep.
Right.
So sometimes, you know, I have parents who are quite rigid about a certain amount of sleep or a certain bedtime, and child resists maybe because they're not tired. So we have to realize
sure.
okay, what's normal for your child, what stage of development are they in, you know, how old are they? Just take all that into account and then practice good sleep hygiene. I think we have to distinguish sometime between insomnia, which is a difficulty falling asleep, versus, you know, frequent nighttime awakening. So many kids have difficulty falling asleep. Usually it's anxiety. Usually there's worries that creep in at night. And we have to teach our kids some calming strategies. So we talk about, you know, breathing techniques, muscle relaxation, again, a calm routine. As much as I just mentioned about you know, screen time and apps. There are actually some good apps out there for mindfulness and some calming routines that a child can use. So I think in a controlled way, you could use a screen for that. But white noise or some music in the background, you know, having the child focus more on the present, the here and now, as opposed to the future that they can't predict or the past that they can't change. I think it's just a good skill for a kid to learn. And that often helps with the brain calming down and then settling to sleep. And what happens is our brains, you know, calm down, we fall asleep, we go into deep sleep, and then we cycle between deep sleep and REM sleep, deep sleep and REM sleep. And REM sleep is, you know, where a lot of rejuvenation happens. Our eyes move quickly back and forth. That's what REM stands for, rapid eye movement. And that's actually just below the level of arousal. So what happens if some kids, if they're in an underlying hyper-aroused state, let's say they're stressed or anxious, you know, instead of, you know, going up to REM sleep, they go to aroused. They wake up. And so they wake up and they're aroused. And it's difficult for them to calm themselves to go back down to sleep again. And so many of us wake at night normally and we're able to almost fall asleep instantaneously. We don't even remember it anymore. But some kids have difficulty with becoming awake at night multiple times, difficulty settling back to sleep. And of course, they're going to have a shorter duration of restorative sleep. And that's going to be reflected in their function the next day.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. So what do you do when a child is struggling that way?
Well, you got to look again, like, why is this child anxious? What is the stressor? Why are they hyper aroused? What can we do to address what's underneath the surface there, right? Again, the sleep difficulty is the tip of the iceberg. It's what we see. It's what we can measure. If you go to a sleep lab, that's exactly what you do. Yes. But what is the problem underneath the surface that's leading to the child being in that state in the first place? So that's why, you know, kids who have PTSD or traumatic stress, they tend to be exhibiting sleep difficulties. Sleep difficulty is one of the most common ways that trauma expresses itself.
Mm, okay. Can we shift to autism? What exactly is autism, and what should parents do who are parenting a child with autism?
Yeah. Well, autism is diagnosed when you recognize that there is social communication difficulties and what we call restricted and repetitive behaviors. Those are the two sort of domains of function and behavior that are affected in autism.
When do parents typically start to recognize these?
Well, and that's the thing. Autism is usually not recognized in the first few years of life. In fact, it's very hard to notice until the child starts to develop more social communication. And then we realize, hey, it's not on track. You know, maybe their speech develops later or in an unusual way. Social communication involves eye contact and recognizing facial movements and facial cues, and the child's not responding to those in the right way. And so the earliest we would probably diagnose it now would be like about 18 months, although there's lots of research going on right now about how do we can recognize this earlier. But really in that first year or two would be the earliest that we could recognize it. Typically, a child will come to attention before school age. Right. But again, here there's a whole spectrum. Autism is a spectrum. It's ASD, autism spectrum disorder.
Yes.
So you can have high functioning autism or Asperger's, as we used to call it, versus more classic autism, which are kids who are nonverbal, who have a lot of repetitive movements, you know, spinning, rocking, etc. Or very repetitive speech or echoing speech. And that's more what we considered more the classic autism versus high functioning autism, where it's an unusual type of speech or it's excessive speech. Often those kids have a very well-developed vocabulary. Their restricted behaviors and might be more enthusiasms. I love how Barry Prezant talks about that in our diagnosis on autism, on our episode on autism. He talks about enthusiasms, and those are things to be developed and nurtured as opposed to suppressed. Sure. Because many of the behaviors that we see in autism are actually ways of coping. They're kind of stress behaviors, and we need to recognize that only when behaviors in autism become really problematic or difficult? Should we try to maybe steer or direct those children in a different direction so that, you know, they don't hurt themselves or others, and can maybe, you know, learn and flourish when those behaviors don't get in the way?
Yeah, it sounded like Barry Prezant had a lot of experience with working with kids who had enthusiasms, or seeing parents who were in, who were really harnessing that enthusiasm to open up channels of communication and help their child develop in ways that they had no idea their child could was capable of.
Yeah, and that's, you know, in, again, there's a whole spectrum of those enthusiasms or restricted interests. You know, sometimes the classic ones is the kids, all they're interested in is dinosaurs, or Thomas the Train is a classic one as well. I'm not sure why, but sometimes there's something about Thomas the Train that's especially appealing to kids that are on the spectrum. But, you know, if you think about some of the most incredible geniuses in the world had enthusiasm, which led to incredible breakthroughs and discoveries, because they just knew so much and were so in tune and able to understand an issue or a topic or a course of scientific reasoning or understanding that led to great discoveries and great development of our knowledge and benefits for everybody. So I you know, you need to keep those in perspective, that sometimes these are just great things that are more often autism, especially at that high end of the spectrum. I like to think of it more as a difference as opposed to a disorder. And I think many kids and adults and adolescents that are on the spectrum probably prefer to think of it that way as well. And every child is different. Every adolescent and teenager and adult who is on the spectrum has their own preference about how they wish to, you know, to be viewed and understood. And I think it's important that we understand, that we respect that.
Sure.
Yeah.
So now, Rob, we're coming to the end of our time, but I wanted to ask you about how you have seen the COVID pandemic, which now is, you know, we're out of the acute phase. It looks like we're entering into a season where we can be more open and we've got more people vaccinated. So that's a good thing. But we still have the mental health implications from all that we've gone through lingering.
Yeah.
So what are you seeing?
Definitely eating disorders are on the rise, anxiety, depression, as I mentioned before. And now, of course, we've lost a lot of school, you know, over the last year. And these kids are all going to go back to school in September. And the kids that left school in March of 2020 are not the same kids coming back in September 2021. And I think as teachers and as an educational system, as parents, we need to be aware of that. We estimate that kids have probably lost about 7 months of education on average, and that is going to be an unequal loss. There are going to be some kids who have been resilient through this stressor of the pandemic who are going to be just fine, but there's going to be a certain group of kids, usually, you know, kids who are already disadvantaged before, who are going to be even further behind. And so that gap that we always was always there already, that we had difficulty addressing even before COVID, is going to be even wider now. And as a society, we have to realize this and address it.
Hmm. Any ideas for potential solutions, Rob? That sounds like a pretty heavy issue we have to face.
Well, I think the first thing we need to do is just make sure that we manage expectations and that we're able to identify the kids who are struggling so that we can help them. We may have to do some remedial teaching. We may have to provide some support before and after school to the families. I mean, many, many families as a whole struggle during the pandemic. You know, there's a lot of job loss and even financial insecurity, food insecurity, of course, illness, you know, many families, sometimes there is deaths in the family. So families struggle. We need to make sure that we support families so that all the family members can help those kids that have fallen behind. And, you know, when you think about learning, you don't learn when you're stressed. And so if you're anxious, again, thinking about the brain, you know, you're not using that thinking part of your brain. You're resorting to more basic, you know, deeper parts of your brain. Your brain's not open to learning. You're not going to learn new things. So unless a child is calm and feels safe at school and at home, that's when they're going to learn. Right. So we need to make sure that kids have their basic needs met, that they feel safe, that they feel supported, that they're not anxious for what might be happening at home or in society in general. Then they're going to be able to learn. Then their minds are going to be open to learning. And I think then we can close that gap.
Well, Rob, this has been a great, wide-ranging conversation. Mm-hmm. I'm just grateful that I had an opportunity to pick your brain today, and I'm sure it has been helpful for all of you who are listening.
Thanks, Tony. Well, everybody, I hope you enjoyed that conversation as much as I did. Thanks, Tony, for those great questions, and also our listeners for bringing up these questions as well.
Yes, on that note, if you do have any questions, issues, topics you want us to address, we love hearing from you.
Absolutely.
You can reach us on the Smart Family Podcast website or on social, on Instagram and Facebook. We're there as Smart Family Podcast. So please, anytime, reach out. We would love to hear from you.
Mm-hmm. And so we thought we would just maybe summarize three takeaways, Tony,
yes.
Just so that you can go from this episode and maybe focus on three key points.
Yeah. So first, it is so important to know that behavior is just the tip of the iceberg. It can be very distressing. It can be the catalyst that brings us to the pediatrician's office. But actually, we have to see our child's behavior as being just the tip of the iceberg and dig for what lies beneath the surface.
That's great. Yeah, for sure. I think the other main takeaway is that pills don't teach skills. I mean, that was a phrase that we did use. And yeah, there is a role for medications in some situations with some kids who are really struggling because sometimes therapy might be, you know, hard to implement when the symptoms get in the way. And so, yeah, sometimes there's a role for altering that neurotransmitter status in the brain with medication.
And thirdly, sleep is just so important for restoring the brain. You know that, I know that. But the point we want you to take away is that kids sleep best when they're not anxious, and that having a routine before bed that is consistent, that hopefully is at a predictable time, yeah, every night, a predictable order of events, actually helps reduce anxiety for kids who are struggling with it. Mm-hmm. And so that bedtime routine in and of itself is such an important strategy.
Yes, and that will lead to better sleep. And that's going to translate into improved behavior the next day. Mm-hmm. So absolutely. Well, thanks for joining us today on the Smart Family Podcast. We love to bring you information that is useful and relevant and will help boost your parenting to the next level. Because at the Smart Family Podcast, it is our aim to help you love being home.